So hopefully this records. I'm very happy to be here. Certainly wasn't sure what to expect coming to a Catholic college, or a college at all, really. I'm not an academic, and so this is something new for me as well. When we talked in the car on the way back from the airport, Father Richard was explaining that this morning he wanted to dedicate 3 hours to Buddhist monasticism. Not exactly, but that's how it sounded to me at first, and the wheels are turning in my head, and I'm like, how can I talk about Buddhist monasticism for 3 hours? And make it interesting to non-Buddhist monastics. But given that this is a monastic setting, I think it will be interesting to talk about. Now, I get the feeling that some people are simply here to learn about meditation. I know on the poster it said this morning was about Buddhism and meditation. So I'm assuming that there still is a desire for that to be the focus. And this afternoon will actually, for those of you who are sticking around, will actually be hopefully practicing meditation together. But this morning is going to be a little bit theoretical, so I hope you can bear with me. I'm not really going to follow this point by point, but the original intention of this handout was to impress you all. And I think I failed because it's not. It started out as about 4 pages, and that was impressive. But then the environmentalist in me kind of reared his head and said, no, you can't waste that many trees. And so I dropped it down to 1 page, which is far less impressive. But the idea is to give an idea of the structure of the Buddhist path. This is actually the table of contents of a, I guess you could say, a fairly ancient work on Buddhist meditation practice or practice, let's say. Because people come to Buddhism looking for meditation, and that's fine and that's good, and I'm happy to encourage that. You don't have to become Buddhist, is what we always say, to practice Buddhism or to practice Buddhist meditation. But that being said, there's a little more to it than just sitting down on a mat and clearing your mind. That comes under the second part, the concentration part. But sometimes when we say practicing Buddhist meditation or even just being a meditator, we forget something essential, is that there's a context behind the meditation, and it's not a religious or a cultural context, but it's a way of life that has to surround the meditation. Simply sitting down on a mat and expecting to come to understand yourself and the world around you is not realistic. So this is a description of the path. And that this book, which is about, it's as thick as an Oxford dictionary and about as dense, gives a in-depth look at the three aspects of the Buddhist path. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about these three, and hopefully as a side benefit, help to explain a little bit about Buddhist monasticism, which really encompasses these three trainings: the training in morality or virtue, the training in concentration or focus, and the training in wisdom or understanding. So the big one, of course, is the first one. Virtue is, or morality, is how people often see the difference between the laity and the monastic community. It's the most glaringly obvious one. I mean, we don't wear the same clothes, we don't follow the same schedules, live the same lives as ordinary people. So our practice of morality is quite different. Now, with all three of these, they exist on two levels. They exist on the conventional level, which is, in the case of morality, it's rules and regulations and doctrines. And they exist also on the practical or the ultimate level. So on an ultimate level, Buddhism doesn't make a distinction between the laity and the monastic community. Anyone can become enlightened within reason. A child under 7 is considered to be too young, for example. But apart from that, the actual practice of morality is simply the cultivation of abstinence or moral states of mind. And the same goes with concentration and wisdom. And so you could even say or suggest that a person need not ever sit down on a mat, close their eyes, sit in a cross-legged position to become enlightened, to follow all three of these trainings, to be moral, to be focused, and to be wise. All of these things can come naturally. But then we have the second level, which is the formal, institutionalized practice, which is kind of like we have tomato cages to hold up our vegetables. When something is young and growing, or is in the process of cultivation, you need something to bolster it or to prop it up, and that's the framework that we have. So as a Buddhist monastic, I have 220 rules that I have to follow, and those are the ones that we have to recite. So every 2 weeks, the monks will get together and recite these rules. One monk will get up and volunteer to recite the rules. Everyone else will listen, and it takes about a half an hour of reciting. For a half an hour. So there is a very intense sort of structure to it. Apart from the 220 rules, there are hundreds of unenumerated rules, but listed and talked about and discussed and enumerated in various places, but not listed in the main rules. So we've got a very well-defined set of rules. And that's really the difference, that highlights the difference between the monastic community and the laity in Buddhism, is that a lay person can attain the same sort of freedom and peace and happiness that and wisdom that a monastic can. But it's kind of like the difference between walking somewhere and taking a sports car. You've got a much better chance, and it's a much fuller experience, debatably. There's much more potential as a monastic. There's much more power there. And so that's when we describe the monastic community with concentration. It's the same. So that's why I've put down these 40 under concentration. We enumerate 40 different types of meditation practice. Now, your average lay person is not going to get past one or two of those. They may not even get. They may only take up the very bare minimum required to cultivate wisdom, and just as they would with morality. So William, for example, just said he's keeping 5 precepts, 5 rules. That's basic Buddhist morality, and I still consider that to be basic Buddhist morality for myself as well. All the rest of the rules, some of them are even just functional. They don't even have any moral or ethical quality to them. Like, for example, not riding in vehicles. We're talking about maybe the one rule that even that I don't pretend to try to keep. But many, many, many rules like this that were just functional in order to keep the framework, to keep the monastic community intact. But for a monastic, because it's a way of life, because it's a 24-hour round-the-clock endeavor, there's a lot more room for cultivation, a much broader cultivation, and the attainment of supernormal powers, of reading people's minds, of astral travel, remembering past lives, seeing heaven, seeing hell, all these sorts of things that you read about in books or hear about from meditators in India, for example. In Hinduism, they talk about this. Or Christian visions and that kind of thing. So these things that come are much more likely to come to someone who is in a monastic community. And the same goes with wisdom. The basic, all of these things, again, putting them down, the idea was to kind of impress you on how deep and broad the scope is. I'll try to go through and explain what I mean by all these things, but there's a huge body of discourse on the various aspects of reality, like the different types of minds. They enumerate 121 different types of mind that can arise based on the factors that make up that mind. And there's like 50, I always get this wrong, 52 or 53 types of factors that can make up any given mind. And so for a monastic, you would learn these sorts of things. Now, none of it's necessary. And often people, when they hear about this, are actually kind of repulsed. Like, it's not, like, this may not have been why you're here today, for example. For many of you, it's not so interesting to hear about all the many aspects of reality. All you want to do is come here, and someone said, I want to come and find peace and calm, which is fine. Really, that's what it is in the end. But when we're discussing monasticism, and I think it's interesting for many of you to talk about, then there's an incredible amount of depth, and there's much we can go through. So starting with virtue, monastic virtue, in Buddhism, there are all these rules that we have to keep. But I guess I'd like to go back and talk about how it all started. And for some of you, that might be already familiar. But Buddhist monasticism didn't arise as an institution where a bunch of guys got together and said, hey, let's start a monastic order. It arose completely organically. None of this came after the Buddha. None of the monastic structure, monastic rules, none of it came after the Buddha passed away. So there was no evolution of Buddhist monasticism, not theoretically, of course. In practice, as I was talking with Father Richard, there's two sides to everything, the way it should be and the way it is. But the structure that we use in Thailand, as I said, those rules, the 227 rules, were all formulated, according to the text they were anyway, were all formulated by the Buddha by precedent. Each rule was broken before it was established. And that's how the monastic community arose. The Buddha, if you know the Buddha story, the story of the Buddha, he was off meditating in the forest with these five ascetics, and they decided that they would torture themselves. This was a big thing at the time. So they stopped eating, and they would stand on one leg, or they would lying on a bed of nails. You know, the bed of nails, I understand this is where it came from. It came from that time they would lie on thorns, a bed of thorns. And it would be a means of shifting away from sensual gratification. And I think, I know in Christianity, there's this kind of idea as well. The best means of pulling yourself out of the mire of sensual gratification is to go to the other extreme of torturing yourself. And so I'm sure you've heard about these people who self-flagellation and self-mortification, as we call it in Buddhism. And so in India, it was a big thing. It was considered to be the other option. So you've got the one option of being a lay person and living the home life, indulging in sensual pleasures and maybe doing good deeds, being a good religious follower, devotee. And then you had the option of torturing yourself in these various ways. So it was burning yourself. They would stand between fires and scorch themselves or go down in the cold water or go around naked and let the flies and mosquitoes and insects bite them and so on. And the Buddha decided that neither of these was working and found the middle way, which is it's one of the key aspects of Buddhism that people hear about when they first start to study it, is the idea that there is a way to be objective, to not cling to things that are pleasant, but at the same time to not repress or deny or force yourself away from the sensual gratification, to just experience it. So to experience pleasure in the same way that you experience pain, to experience it as it is, without judgment, without partiality, without extrapolating upon it or making more of it than it actually is. And so this was it. This realization allowed him to find what he called the middle way in this path that he cultivated and followed and led himself through these three trainings until he came to understand objectively what we're made of, what is reality made of, what makes up the body, what makes up the mind, what makes up experience. And he came to an experiential view of reality, that all of reality is simply made up of the five aggregates, which are the five aspects of experience, which hopefully I'll talk about a little bit. That the building blocks of reality are not atoms and are not the soul, are not souls, but they are experiences. When you see something, that experience arises. There's a physical aspect to it, and there's an emotional aspect, there's a sensual aspect to it, and there's a mental aspect to it. But that ceases in a moment. So there's the seeing and there's the judging of it, the liking, the disliking, the deciding about it, the cultivation and extrapolation upon it, and then it ceases. And maybe something results from it, or maybe nothing results from it, but something else comes next. And these experiences arise and cease, which it sounds quite simple, but it's actually, if you were sit here and ponder whether this is what I'm saying is true and examine yourself, you can't easily see it. It doesn't seem like that's the way things are. It seems like everything's blurring together in a kind of a me sort of way. So that there's the me I'm here experiencing, and I'm constantly and continuously experiencing. And yet, we've all had that experience where you'll be thinking of something, or you'll be sitting here, for example, giving a talk, and suddenly you lose your train of thought, and you wonder, what happened? Suddenly, it's like you're a new person all of a sudden. That old person, that old train of thought, what was it? What was I thinking of? Just gone. Or you'll have a pain suddenly arise and be in agony for the longest time, and then suddenly it's gone. Or you'll be grieving over something, and suddenly the grief disappears and you're fine again. And you go, that's nice, it's gone. And then it comes back, and you know, you're grieving again. The more you meditate, the more you come to see this change, this arising and ceasing, how experiences arise and cease, and sometimes chaotically. In fact, in the beginning of meditation, you just see just how chaotic the mind can be. How it is just a big mishmash of experiences. So this is what the Buddha realized. But the point there is that he was alone. And he didn't actually go and start a monastic community. He went back to find these five ascetics that had been with him and had abandoned him, and he taught them how to practice and kept them with him. But he didn't set up any rules, and he didn't establish any kind of order. He just, it was kind of like he said, hey, you want to come and stay with me? I'll teach you, and you can become enlightened as well, and understand the things I've understood, and you can go and teach others. He collected together 60 monks, these five ascetics, went out into the villages, and other people would see them and come and decide that this was a neat, there was to see something special about these monks and their manner and their behavior, and want to follow after them. And so it grew into a group of 60 monks, and then the Buddha sent them off in all directions. He said, go forth, taratta bhikkhave, go forth, monks, and wander. But go on different paths. Not two of you should go in the same direction. So he broke up this, what was just forming, and looked like, oh, you've got a monastic community here. Sent them to the four winds. Because in Buddhism, there's this idea, this concept of enlightenment, sainthood, if you would. And so, someone who has attained sainthood, the idea is, okay, they're good now. They can go. They've got it. And they don't need training. They don't need support. And they would go out and create their own communities. I think there's something about that in the Christian writings. You know, the apostles, is that I'm not really up on it. But they would go wandering as well, right? That was the idea. And this went on, and it expanded, and if the texts are to believe, it was quite prolific, until the point came where someone actually did something really, really stupid, and something had to be done. One of the monks, you know, it was never even said, you don't read anywhere where the Buddha said, but if you're going to stay with me, you have to be celibate. It was never really, it was always just sort of understood. And part of that would be because in India it was understood that if you're going off into the forest, you're not going to have sexual intercourse or a romantic life at all. And it happened that one of the followers of the Buddha broke this. It was actually quite innocent. His wife wanted a child, his ex-wife. And so she kept bugging him about it. She said, look, I understand you want to live off in the forest with this recluse, but who's going to carry on your name? Give me a child. And pushed him. And finally he gave in and had sexual intercourse with her, and she became pregnant, and she was happy and went away. And then he felt all guilty about it, and he told the other monks, and they went to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, and the Buddha admonished him and called him a useless person, and how wrong it was for him to do it. And then he set up this rule. And this was, if the texts are to believe, this is how the rules arose. And so then you've got these, we've got seven volumes that comprise the Buddha's teaching on virtue. And about three of them are made up of, no, six volumes. And three of them are comprised of the rules for the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis. And I think even to the point that rule was created, I can't remember the exact order of things, but there still wasn't really a monastic community. But in these three books, you've got a sequence of rules, because then it became a precedence of itself, this idea of going to the Buddha and asking him and bringing problems to him, like, hey, this monk touched a woman, or this monk ate in the evening, or this monk is collecting food or collecting robes or wearing lay people's clothes, or all of the many drinking alcohol, this monk killed a person, this kind of thing, stole something. A monk was off in the forest, and the king had said, let the monks have anything from the forest, anything that they want. He was a Buddhist king in that time. And he said, the stuff in the forest, whatever they find, whatever they can forage in the forest, I give it to the monks. It's not considered stealing, even though it's king's land. And then it happened that the king's loggers or lumberjacks had cut down a bunch of trees and milled some lumber and had left it sitting in the forest. And so this monk came up and saw this, and he took some of it. And then they brought it to the king, and they brought him to the king, and he said, He said, "Well, Your Majesty, you said we could take whatever we wanted from the forest." And the king admonished him and said, "You're like the sheep." He said, "You're like the sheep who is saved by the golden sheep that is saved by its fleece." There's a legend of a sheep that has golden fleece, and they wouldn't kill it because its fleece was golden. So he didn't punish him because he was a monk. The point is, because he was a monk, he didn't punish him. So you have stories like that. You got some really interesting, and if you're just interested in the history of religious history or Indian history, even, it's quite a read. As much of the texts are, it's not really as dry as it seems. But the key difference, I think, something we were talking about yesterday, is that the Buddha had 45 years to do this. And that makes a big difference. Those 45 years were spent making these rules. It's not hard to understand where this all came from and how it all came up, actually, in the time of the Buddha. With Buddhism, you don't just have an idea or a belief a value system, belief system. You have actually a methodical path of training that is laid out in excruciating detail, and that's what you get with the monastic rules. So apart from that, you'd have little things like how to carry your bowl, and you couldn't, rules like when you open a door, you have to put your bowl down first. Don't open a door carrying your bowl, because the bowl could fall and smash. The minute details of how to live your monastic life. And so this is the difference between monastic and secular or lay morality. But something it's more interesting from a meditative point of view when we talk about morality in an ultimate sense, which applies to the laity as well as it does to the monastic community. And I wanted to just say something briefly about this, that morality is highly debated in religious circles. In Christianity, I think the general agreement is morality is absolute. There are certain things that are absolutely immoral. I suppose there's not even that consensus. But you have the commandments, so thou shalt not, and so it's absolute. Killing is absolute. It's wrong, and there's a reason for that. It's against God's commandment. And then there's relative morality or utilitarian morality, where something is only immoral based on the results that it brings. So if the one we always get is, if killing Hitler could save lots and lots of people, could you really say that it was immoral to do so? This is a moral conundrum, a dilemma for us. Sam Harris, I just don't suppose anyone here reads Sam Harris. He's not very kind towards certain forms of religion. But he brings this up. There's this train dilemma where there's a train going down a track, and it's coming to a T intersection, and you hold this lever in your hand where you can switch it one way or the other. And if you switch it one way, it's headed towards an innocent person. And if you could switch it, and this innocent person is lying tied up on the railroad tracks, and if you could switch it the other way, it would go and it would hit a murderer or an evil person. And these kind of these kind of conundrums. There's the ticking time bomb. If you have someone who has planted a time bomb in a public location, would it be ethical to torture them to get that information? What means could you go to try to get that information? Oh, Buddhism, and why I want to talk about this, because Buddhism takes a kind of a cheater's position on this. Buddhism says that morality is both absolute and utilitarian. So the reason why certain things are absolutely unconscionable is because they absolutely, without fail, lead to bad consequences, lead to suffering. So the definition of something that is evil is that it leads to suffering. The definition of something that is good is that it leads to happiness. It is a utilitarian definition, but the claim is that there are certain things that when performed, there are certain realities that when they arise cannot help but bring suffering and cannot help but bring happiness. And this is the concept of karma. Karma in Buddhism, karma was a concept in India that everyone here I'm sure knows. But the concept in early Hinduism, or what was there, Brahmanism, Vedic religion in India, was the concept of ritual action. That there were certain actions, often complex series of actions, the creation of the fire altar, the ritual chanting and dancing or so on, that as an action, regardless of the state of mind, would lead to some positive result, the favor of the gods, or lead to heaven or even enlightenment. And so you have these, if you have ever read the Vedas and you've ever read these, the nature of these, some of these sacrifices, it's ridiculous for us to read. It seems quite silly in ways. The one that we read was they built this altar in the shape of an eagle, and then under the altar you have to bury a lump of butter. Then you have a post. I'm probably going to get this all mixed up, but you have a post that you set in the ground, and you bring a goat, and you have to show the post to the goat and then take the goat away. Has anyone ever heard this? Can you imagine why they're doing this? You know why they're doing this? The lump of butter, actually, the problem is the original sacrifices were so cruel that they didn't survive. And the original sacrifices, you bury a live turtle under the altar and take a goat and cut off its head and pour the blood over the altar. And that became so cruel, eventually people just couldn't handle it anymore, and so they said, well, we'll just take a lump of butter instead. and the pole, well, we'll just, as long as he sees the post, that's enough. We're content with that. The gods won't mind, really. So the evolution of it. But the point, that it became more poignant, that actually it had even less meaning, significance, except as a ritual. And that's what karma was. This word karma, it had a very powerful meaning. It was a very powerful doctrine, the idea that an act in and of itself was enough to curry favor with the gods, or with reality, enough to change reality. Kind of like a magic spell that you could wave your hand and say the right words and voila, magic. So, in fact, the Buddha rejected outright the concept of karma. The pinnacle of karma, of course, is in the Bhagavad Gita, of the Mahabharata. Many of you must have heard of the Bhagavad Gita. In brief, it's this. It's The pinnacle of it is this moment where Arjuna, this guy in battle, is conflicted because he realizes that the people he's fighting against, the people he's killing, are his fellow Indians, his fellow countrymen. And he's always been told that killing is wrong. It's actually probably an evolutionary trait for us to think that killing is wrong, because you know, if you kill people, you don't proliferate. So he knew that this was wrong, and especially killing your countrymen is certainly not beneficial by any standard or moral. And so he has trouble, and he stops, and he can't fight anymore. And Krishna, who is driving his chariot, the guy who's riding his chariot, exposes himself as Krishna, the great and one God or whatever, and teaches him and says, you know, it doesn't matter. As long as you follow your code, this is moral in the eyes of God. If you're a warrior, then you follow the warrior code. Does anyone know the word that they would use? The warrior dharma. You know this word dharma? Dharma. And it's important to bring up these words because this is the Buddha. Everyone hears, what do you know about Buddhism? Do they believe in karma? Of course they believe in karma. Buddhists, one of their main beliefs is karma. And then what is the teaching of the Buddha? It's called the Dharma. The Buddha Dharma. So if you don't know any of this backstory, you think it's all Buddhist concepts, but it's actually kind of the Buddha tongue-in-cheek making fun of the religions that came before. Because Dharma, the word Dharma, Dhar comes from, Dhar is the root, means to carry. Or to carry with you, or to guard, and or to hold would be the English parallel. Because what these people held, so if you're a warrior, you have to hold. We hold that our duty is to kill. Our duty is to fight. He says, so if you're doing your duty, you're just a pawn in all of this. You're the soldier, and you're on this side. So your duty is to fight this side. It's not that you're right and they're wrong. It's that this is your duty to kill them. Their duty is to kill you. If you do that, you're right in the eyes of God. And same goes with the merchants. The merchant's duty is to conduct business. The servant's duty is to be servants. As long as you fulfill your duty, your role in the whole wheel of existence, then it's cool. You're going to heaven. The servants are going to heaven if they're good servants, slaves even. The merchants go to, if they're good merchants, and the warriors, if they're good warriors, they don't have to win. It doesn't matter who wins or loses, but if they perform their duty according as it's been laid out, then they go to heaven. And again, this is harkens back to the idea of ritual karma. You do it because it's absolutely good to do. And the Buddha rejected this. Rejected the idea that an act in and of itself can be good or evil. In contrast with their fellows, the giants, and the difference becomes clear when you look at what the giants believe. The giants believe that if you're walking down the street and you're just walking, not paying attention, and you step on an ant or a cockroach, you're guilty of murder. That in and of itself is an unethical deed. And so you see them often walking down the paths with a broom in their hand, and they have to sweep in front of them, and they wear these masks so that they don't inhale any insects. And the curious thing is they had this debate once. I think it was the Buddha had this debate with a giant once. And the curious thing is, it's enough that they tried. No, as long as they were sweeping, it actually didn't matter if they stepped on an ant. So if they had the good intention to sweep in front of them, and they still happened to step on an ant, or they had this mask and somehow an insect got in, they were blameless. And the Buddha pointed this out to them. Well, you know, honestly, what you're talking about here, no matter how you how you describe it, you're still talking about intention. What's more important, the mind or the body? There's this belief that it's important to have this ritual action. But if you have the good intention not to kill already, so this is the key difference, that in Buddhism it would never be wrong to... You would never be guilty of murder. You would be guilty of negligence, perhaps. So a person who doesn't de-ice their front walk is guilty of negligence. They're not guilty of murder if the person dies, if a person slips and breaks their neck. And that is the key, the essence of true Buddhist morality. It's not actually talking about rules. Now I know I'm going to get back to this hopefully and talk a little bit more about monastic morality, but I want to get this clear that the essence of morality in Buddhism is not about rules. It's about the state of mind. And so murder, we say, is always wrong. If you intend to kill someone, your mind is always polluted. It can never be not polluted. We do make that claim. But it has to be entirely dependent, the weight of it is entirely dependent on the states of mind involved. So if you spend a month planning out the murder of someone who trusts you, planning out the murder of your parents, for example, as opposed to getting in a bar fight and killing someone in a moment of a fit of rage, the former has a much, much stronger karmic weight to it. It's much, much more likely to be with you, obviously. I mean, it's actually quite easy to understand this. The truth of karma is those moments. Every moment that you have hatred for someone, every moment that you have desire for someone's belongings, leads you to steal, you've already committed a bad karma. So from a meditative point of view, the rules are not even all that important. What's important is the ordering of the mind, keeping the mind from falling into greed, into anger, into delusion. And by delusion meaning arrogance or conceit or wrong views and so on. And so the monastic rules are simply an extension of that. Even the five precepts, the five rules, not to kill, not to steal, not to cheat, not to lie, and not to take drugs and alcohol, these are just an extension of that. There is, again, this framework to keep the mind in a moral state. And so the monastic community that eventually formed up was just the way of putting down posts. You know, if you have a want to keep your horses locked up, tied up, corralled up, first thing you do is put down posts. Now the posts themselves won't keep the horses in, just as the rules won't keep people moral. But that's where you build your fence, and that's where you begin to keep the mind in check. So these rules arose, and as a result, the monastic community arose. The ordination procedure, originally, it was simply a matter of getting the Buddha's permission. If you came up to the Buddha and he said, okay, come be a monk, then you're in. That was ordination. Eventually, of course, this didn't work because the Buddha was one and India was very, very big. And so he granted permission for the monks to ordain their students. And it was simply a reciting, I go to the Buddha for refuge, I go to the Dhamma for refuge, I go to the Sangha for refuge. The Buddha is the Buddha, the Dhamma is his teaching, Dharma. And the Sangha is the community of monks that had built up, or the community of enlightened beings that had realized the truth. And eventually even that became problematic, because then you have, well, what if you have a monk who's not quite kosher, not quite following the rules, and then he ordains another monk, and then he ordains another monk, and eventually you've got a whole lineage that kind of sketchy. You get that even today. You get that already even with the system. But in order to avoid that, the next thing the Buddha did is set up the concept of a monastic quorum. 10 monks at the time would constitute a monastic quorum. And so he said, from now on, no more I ordain you, you ordain him, and so on. 10 monks are required to sit down and have one monk recite 3 times the intentions of the monk. Who is the monk's preceptor? Who is the guy who's going to teach this monk? What's his name and what the intention is to ordain him? You recite it 3 times. So we do this even today, recite it in ancient Pali, and most of the monks actually don't know what's being said. So. But there's an understanding that this is really happening, and if anyone feels it shouldn't happen, they should speak up. And if anyone spoke up, they'd have to stop and address the concerns and maybe change their minds and not ordain this person. And that, still in the Buddha's lifetime, arose as the official way that we even use, even today, to ordain Buddhist monks. So then there was the idea of a preceptor, and the idea that you have to stay with your preceptor for 5 years. It grew up, and there was a structure to it. But what didn't arise, and we were talking about this yesterday, which is kind of curious, was the concept of obedience. The concept of having to take orders from someone, having to get permission. So there's the idea that you need permission to leave the monastic, to go somewhere. There's very, very little of a sense of permission in Buddhism, in the Buddhist monastic community. Again, it's marked by this first 60 monks who just wandered to the four winds to lead their communities, but there never arose even the concept of a monastic leader. The Buddha had laid down a rule in terms of seniority, simple seniority. There was no rank, there was no merit, a system of merit or promotion. If I ordain today and you ordain tomorrow, I'm senior to you. Which still mostly had simply to do with benefits. So when distributing cloth or distributing food, the senior monks would get first. The senior monks would sit in the first in order, would walk first on alms round and so on. Simple respect. But when they get together and have to decide something, it goes simply by the quorum. If 10 monks can get together and decide unanimously that it should be thus, then in that community, all the monks get together, if they can agree unanimously, and there's at least 10 of them, then it's considered to be an act of the Sangha, act of the community. There was no idea of an abbot. An abbot is a very fairly recent thing in Buddhism. So nowadays you have abbots, and you even have Sangharaja, which means like supreme patriarch, kind of like the Pope. Except there's one in Thailand, there's one in Sri Lanka, one in Burma, and so on. But you have a real system of government. That's not Buddhist. That's not in the Buddhist teaching. It's not canonical in any way. And it seems actually to have been, to be going against what is written in the text. So that's Buddhist monasticism. The only other thing that I'd talk about, and I guess I'll answer people's questions after I hopefully go through these other two. I don't know how much time I have. Is to talk about women monastics, because I think this is something, it's a curious case, even not thinking about the gender inequality issues. It's an interesting example of how Buddhist monasticism works, again, by precedent. I've already talked about the progression of ordination, and maybe it'll be interesting as well from a point of monastic or religious jurisprudence. It's quite a technical argument. The general stance today among monks in my tradition is that women can't ordain, that it's not possible for a woman to become a monk. And they go by the fact that, as the rules stand today, the method of ordination for women is first to ordain with a quorum of female monks, and then to come and have it ratified by the community of male monks. And so the argument goes, there are no female monks left. They died out in our tradition. As a result, you don't have the quorum, you can't ordain female monks. Interestingly, curiously, it's actually not correct according to the texts. I'm quite clear, having read the texts, that ordaining female monks is fine. You need a quorum of male monks and you've got it done. And here's how it goes. In the beginning, monks could ordain just one monk. Then the Buddha said, no, don't do that. No, or then, and that was only the Buddha. Only the Buddha could do that, so that's fine. He didn't ever rescind that. So at any time he wanted, he could just ordain people. Then he had, you have to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and that was the way. And then he said, don't do that anymore. Anyone who does that is wrong. Anyone who ordains that way is not ordained. Now, ordain with a quorum of monks. Get the quorum of monks together, and that's an ordination. With the female monks, how did that start? It couldn't start with a quorum, obviously, so how did it start? It didn't actually start with the Buddha saying, come be a bhikkhuni. The problem with female ordination, one of the problems, or the main problem with female ordination, was that you had a bunch of men living off in the forest. And their whole reason for being off in the forest was to live a celibate life, free from temptation. I mean, that's the point. The point of leaving is to leave this behind. And this, a big part of that was women. And so it's undeniable that that was an issue, and you can't talk around that and say, well, there is an issue here that has to be addressed. How do you then accommodate both genders in a celibate environment? It's not impossible, obviously, but it's more difficult. It's more challenging. So this issue arose, and there was this concern. And yet, the first thing the Buddha did was, when you had these women who wanted to ordain, they said, well, there's nobody to ordain them. And they said, I allow the monks to ordain the nuns, the male monks to ordain the female monks. And that's where ordination for women started. The monks would do it ostensibly in the same way that they would ordain male monks. They'd get a quorum together, have her shave her head and put on robes, and ordain her. The only reason that changed, interestingly enough, is because the women, you know, before you ordain, you do have to pass certain qualifications, which maybe I should have mentioned. You have to be human. In the beginning, you had to be male. You have to be a fully functioning human being. You can't be crippled. You can't be mentally challenged, and so on. Because, again, being a monk, it's not the essence of Buddhism. So people would say, well, that's unfair for to say, you know, you can't be this, you can't be that to become a monk. But it speaks of the nature of being a monk as being something powerful, something that has a great power and therefore responsibility to it. You can't be a burden on the monastic community or be a burden to yourself such that you're unable to fulfill these quite arduous rules and regulations. Only eating once a day. For many people, that's with certain illnesses, that's impossible. not being able to ride in vehicles, that kind of thing. Living the life of a monk. Not using money, obviously the big one. If you don't have money and then you need this or you need that, you have to be very, very self-reliant and very, very reliant on nothing. You have to be able to live your life in complete contentment. And so it's difficult. And so for women, you know, some of these questions got a little bit personal. And so the women, when especially in India, there would be a sense of, well, some serious reticence in answering such personal questions, and so they wouldn't answer them. The monks would ask them, you know, are you a woman, and so on and so on, and do you have this sickness, that sickness, and they would be embarrassed and they wouldn't answer. And so the only reason that the Buddha instated this, where they would first ordain with a quorum of bhikkhunis, is the quorum of female monks, is because they refused to answer the question in front of the monks. First they said, the Buddha said, well then, take the woman off to the side and have one male monk ask her the question. She still wouldn't answer them. And so we had, the Buddha said, well in that case, have her ordain first with the female monks and then with the male monks. And curiously, he did not say, no longer have the bhikkhus ordain the bhikkhunis. No longer have the male monks ordain the female monks. And so, according to Buddhist jurisprudence, you have a loophole, at least. But at best, you obviously have this case where there was nothing wrong with the way it was done. It just wasn't possible. It wasn't working that way. And so you needed a plan B. And so in the case of the bhikkhunis, you have the female monks, you have something quite different from the case of the ordination of the monks, where the Buddha said, no, don't do that anymore. You have this case where the Buddha gave options. And that's where it stands today, quite clearly possible, especially in the case where there is no quorum of bhikkhuni, of female monks to be found. The case where you have the ability to ordain female monks with male monks. Anyway, I thought that would be an interesting peek into some of the debates that we have. The last thing about virtue that I want to mention, just because it's on here, is the ascetic practices. That in Buddhism, we do have practices that are above and beyond what is required. So there's the idea of an actual practice of morality, where someone says, he or she's a monk, has to keep the basic precepts. But then on top of that, wants to undertake some serious moral training. And so you have what are called the ascetic practices. There are 13 practices, and they're the kind of the harsh sort of, as close as we'd get to torturing yourself without actually doing it. These would be things like living under a tree, living in the forest, which, believe it or not, isn't a requirement. Living out in the open, living in a graveyard, using only 3 robes, eating only alms food, so declining the invitation to a meal. Because another aspect of Buddhist monasticism is the alms round. We still today do go walking barefoot through the streets. Even I've spent months doing it in North Hollywood, walking through the streets. I actually have a video, I don't know if you saw my video, alms round in North Hollywood. Wonderful place. It's ironic, you'd think that it would be the rural areas that would be most suitable for Buddhist monasticism, but that certainly isn't the case, as I found out in California. I was living in California for a couple of years, and I started out in North Hollywood and moved around the San Fernando Valley. And never really had a problem because I was always staying in the urban areas. I ended up staying in a mansion in Tarzana, and it was for sale, and there was a problem with it. So they said, "Well, you can just stay there for now." And we go walking to this French restaurant and a Thai restaurant, and all sorts of wonderful people giving me food, keeping me alive. and never had a problem. And then I moved out to San Luis Obispo County by the ocean, which is a wonderful place, and there's park and trees, and the whole feeling changed. It's that suddenly people were suspicious, and the police were stopping me and asking me questions, and then they got arrested. I was put in jail, actually, because they thought I was a streaker. And I spent... I don't even think that's true, because I was ridiculous how it happened, but it seemed very much, very suspicious how it happened, kind of like there were forces at work. But I spent a night in jail, and so honestly, you laugh at the idea of going on alms round in the city, but it's actually quite an enlightening experience, and it can be quite wonderful to bring something like that to the city. Anyway, this is a part of our practice. But it's not a required element. So if people bring food to the monasteries, monks would accept the food, or if people invited the monks for a meal in their house, the monks would go for a meal. But it becomes more complicated then, you see. There's something simple, something wonderfully convenient, for lack of a better word, to going on alms round, because you're not tied to anyone or anything. I had a real problem with that in Sri Lanka, because they'd always ask me, "Are you coming tomorrow?" And I understand that, you know, they want to be ready with food if I'm coming tomorrow. But then I think, what if something comes up tomorrow and I have to go somewhere, or I have to come back and tell them I'm not coming, or I get their phone number or this or that? And they would get quite upset when I said to them, "I don't know. Present moment. I can't, tomorrow I don't know." It's so wonderful to not be in that position where, as in India, people would not necessarily be waiting, but if they saw a monk come by and they had food, they would say, "Hey, come, I've got something I can offer you, something to eat." We do that in Thailand, in Sri Lanka, in all these countries. In India, I heard that even Saint Francis, you have a saint who enjoined his students to go on alms round, and it's a familiar story where all of his students refused to, or ended up slacking off and not going on alms round. It's familiar because the same sort of thing happens in Buddhism. So these ascetic practices are a means of getting back to that, getting back to a very ideal state of life. And that's sort of it's exemplary of the sort of things that Buddhist monastics would get into. Okay, so just briefly, I'm going to talk about the other two, concentration and wisdom, because really they don't have that much to do with Buddhist monasticism. Again, being the realm of all Buddhists or all people. So the key thing to do next, once you've undertaken virtue on whatever level you wish, whether it be keeping 5 or 200 rules, is to undertake to find a meditation practice or a meditation subject. And so they outline 40 here in this text. But it's a real involved process, and that's what's so impressive about the detailed table of contents, because before you take the meditation, you have to consider your teacher, you have to consider the meditation center, you have to consider your own inclination, because not all of these subjects are suitable for everyone. A person who is full of anger, to give you an example, will not benefit from focusing on foulness. And foulness here refers to the foulness inherent in the body, because that's a suitable object of contemplation for someone who is full of lust, full of attachment to carnal pleasures. It offsets that. It helps, because it's not imagination, it's real. The body really can be disgusting. It has aspects to it that are disgusting. When you see that, you tend to lose your intoxication with the body, which is equally conceptual. There's nothing about the body that is good or bad, but we lean so far to one side and obsess over the body as being something beautiful that it can be quite a refreshing realization that the body has its negative aspects as well. So they would go to the graveyard, the charnel ground, where the people just threw their corpses, or poor people would just wrap it up in a cloth and throw it in the charnel ground. And they'd go and look at these corpses and watch them become bloated and purple and whatever, green, and suddenly the pus is running out of the orifices and they're cracking and breaking up and eventually turning to bone, and it's can be quite eye-opening, enlightening. Because that's the fate of us all, right? We're worm food. And yet for some people that's bad. Some people would do that and just become so horrified that they'd want to kill themselves. For those people, it's not a good meditation subject. Recollection on death, the 10 recollections, there's a whole bunch. It's quite varied. One of them is a recollection of death. Again, probably not a good subject for someone who is suicidal, say. And then on the other hand, you have the divine abidings, which are love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. So these sound a lot more enticing for all of us. Everyone wants to meditate on love or compassion, or joy, equanimity. And yet these ones might not be suitable for someone who is already full of love. And by love, then it would include eros, and not just pathos, but erotic or thoughts of lust. Because suppose you're sitting there, and I'm sending love to this woman I know, and so on. It's quite easy for it to slip over into something else. So, if for someone who is of a lustful temperament, again, can be dangerous. So, many things to consider when taking a meditation subject. And this text goes into some detail about the types of things you have to look for in a teacher, a place, things you have to do before you meditate. You can't just say, okay, today, here I am, tomorrow I'm going to go off in the forest, find a teacher and meditate. There are many things you have to do to prepare yourself. So you have to cut off all sorts of ties to family, ties to students. You have to cut off you have to take care of illnesses you have to get your affairs in order. And so it talks about this. It's quite methodical, the process of choosing a meditation practice. There's a preparation that has to be undertaken. But then once you find a teacher, hopefully the teacher can see in you what your temperament is and assign you a meditation practice. The first 10 are the kasinas, and this is a not necessarily Buddhist, particularly Buddhist meditation practice, but it's these 10. Kasina, the word I think means totality. And so it's referring to the idea that you become totally absorbed in one concept. And so the 10 are earth, air, water, fire, blue, yellow, red, white, light, and space. I don't know if I got those right. I think that's 10. That's all. Almost, something like that. And so you'd take one of these. You'd actually create something, a disc in most cases, of earth. Get some red, nice red clay that didn't have any blemishes in it, and make it into a circle, put it on the ground, and then sit cross-legged and actually look at this sphere and say to yourself, earth, 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 just looking at it and impressing upon your mind this concept of earth. They're simple meditations. I actually did a series of videos for kids, and I incorporated the idea of the kasinas into the video. And later on, I was doing a Skype with one of my students, and she brought her children out. And I asked them how their meditation was going, and they said, yes, yes, blue, blue, blue. This three-year-old was actually getting this concept of meditation. She could meditate on blue. She knew how to do it. Very simple. There's no Buddhist doctrine in there. There's nothing particularly Buddhist about these. But they're a means of focusing the mind, of clearing away all of the rubbish and garbage in the mind. A means of preparing the mind for introspection. So if it was a color, you'd again just say blue, blue, or white, white, and so on. And eventually, you get to the point where you don't need to look anymore. You can close your eyes and you can see the disc in your mind. And you continue saying to yourself, earth, 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 or blue, blue, blue. Until eventually you enter into high states of concentration. And for a monk, this would be a very, very involved endeavor where you would even try to cultivate it. As best you could, you would try to cultivate it when you were, for example, walking on alms round. Difficult, but maybe not to that extent. But anyway, you would be doing it throughout the day. In certain cases, the meditations could be carried out. For love, for example, you would walk on alms round full of love. But in the case of the kasinas, not sure. But you would undertake it to such an extent that eventually you would become absorbed in the color or in the element. And suddenly your mind would be fixed, will become fixed on the object. And then you enter into what is called the jhanas, or the absorptions. And this would be very similar to the type of meditation they would practice in early Hinduism, in the Upanishads, for example. They would get into these states of such high concentration that no thought came into their minds. Then they start to play games. Then the fun starts. Then you can expand the disc in your mind until it becomes a totality. So there's nothing but white or blue or earth. And everything, your whole universe, is that thing. In Buddhism, one of the meditations they use is Buddha. So when the breath goes in, they'll say to themselves, Buddha. And when the breath goes out, they'll say, Dho, Buddho. Buddho means the Buddha. So I think the way Christian people, when they adapt, the Christians, they adapt this, they say to themselves, Jesus, Jesus. And eventually you become fixed on that object, whatever it is, if it could be a picture of Jesus. And you expand it until that's your whole... These type of meditations are infinite. There's obviously far more than 40 of them. But as an example, these concepts become your totality. And then you can go to all sorts of crazy states, because then once the whole universe becomes that, then you can focus simply on the whole universe. And it's not like the stars and the Milky Way and so on. It's this sense of the entirety. I don't know if you ever get this in your prayers, but sense of the wholeness of creation, as you would say. And you focus on that, and then the earth or the color disappears, and suddenly you've got this sense of infinite space, of the infinitude of space. And you have this consciousness that's infinite. And you go deeper and deeper, and anyway, they go on and on and on. And eventually you can use these to cultivate supernormal powers. And there's lots of instruction about that. How to remember past lives, for example. To remember past lives, you go through a series of meditations until you become completely proficient and your mind is very, very sharp. And then you start to remember. You sit down. And you think back to, what was I doing just before I sat down? And because your mind is bright and sharp and you've been practicing meditation intensively for some time, it's not difficult. And then you say, okay, and what was I doing right before that? And you remember back and back and back and back and back. And whenever you lose the chain of causality, you come back and you start meditating again. Go back through the meditations, blue, 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 or whatever it is you're focusing on. And try again. And you go through this all the way back to the moment of conception. You can actually, as texts say, go back all the way to the moment of conception. And encourage interested parties to try that. I mean, whether you believe in past lives or not, it's not important, but quite an interesting exercise to see how far back your memory really can go. Because for most of us, we think, well, those memories are gone, they're never coming back. I probably didn't ever have any memories during the time I was in my mother's womb. I think it'd be an interesting exercise to prove that right or wrong. With a mind that's bright, there are very strange things that can happen. I once had an experience when I was younger, believe it or not, up to you, where I was sitting in... I was following all sorts of meditations when I was younger. Deepak Chopra was a big one. And what I would do is I would lie in bed and feel my body swaying like a hammock. It wasn't moving, but I could feel it. And I got really good at this to the point where I could do loops. And it really felt like I'm lying there. Oh, and it was a wonderful feeling going in loops and loops and loops and loops. And this went on for some time and I started experimenting. And eventually, one day, I was doing it head to toe, where suddenly the hammock was swinging from my head to my feet. And back and forth and back and forth. And suddenly, I popped out of my body. Well, it wasn't like a pop, but it was like I slipped out of my body. And it's kind of like a dream. So you could say you were just asleep. But it was kind of dreamlike. And I floated downstairs. Dreamlike also in the sense that I didn't have any control. I don't know if I could have controlled it if I wanted to, but it was very much like I was there for the ride. And I floated downstairs into the kitchen and saw my brother standing at the counter pouring a bowl of cereal. And I watched as he poured the bowl of cereal, closed the box up, poured the milk, and then turned to put the box of cereal back in the pantry and elbowed his bowl of cereal onto the floor and it smashed into lots and lots of pieces. That was it. Floated back upstairs, slipped back into my body, and woke up. And that was it. So I got up, walked downstairs, went into the kitchen, saw my brother pour a bowl of cereal, pour the milk into the bowl, turn to put the cereal back, knock the bowl of cereal off the counter with his elbow. I was 13. So anyone who talks to me about these sorts of things, I tend to have an open mind. And I think it's worth having an open mind about these sorts of things because we really don't have laws on, no matter what the materialists say, we don't have definite laws on the nature of reality. We have observations that seem to suggest that such things are impossible. But those observations are made in situations that are quite controlled and quite normal. So if 99% of the time magical powers are impossible, then science will tell you they're impossible. Obviously, 99%, I mean, you can't get much better than that. But if once in a million times this happens, it's anecdotal, which is meaningless. It's a problem with science. It really is a problem, right? Anyway, so that's concentration. Now, the takeaway from that is not the magical powers. Magical powers in Buddhism, has to be said categorically, are optional, are a byproduct of concentration. At best, they're a means of enticing people to practice meditation. Like, hey, look what we got. Hey, kid, want some candy? That kind of thing. It's candy, it's not medicine. You won't become enlightened, you won't become free from suffering. It's not real freedom. Even the calm that comes from meditation is not true freedom. People often practice meditation as an escape. And what I'm going to try to stress when we start in the meditation is that if meditation is a means of avoiding something, then you're always going to be disappointed, because there will always be something that you have to avoid, and I can't keep that from you. The parable is, the allegory, I'm not good on my head, is of a person who finds out that the earth is covered in broken glass. When you know that the earth is covered in broken glass, you have two options. One, you can cover the whole earth in leather. Or two, you can wear sandals. The choice is yours. Most people take the first approach. We try to cover up everything that causes us suffering. Make sure that we don't experience that. We don't come in contact with the broken glass. And that's what the leather is. So most meditation, but most people's standard of meditation is a means of insulating yourself. Of course, the allegory breaks down, but the idea of insulating yourself so you don't have to come in contact with those things that cause you suffering. Now, the meditation that I'm going to hopefully instruct you on is the other option, the option of changing your state so that you can come in contact with all of the things that currently make you suffer. Pain, memories, experiences, loud noises, grating noises, bad tastes, smells, everything. That which is fearsome, that which is foreign, all the things that cause us suffering. To experience them without suffering. Pain is a good example. It's one I always like to bring up. Everyone will agree that pain is a horrible, horrible, bad, bad thing. And yet, in fact, what is pain? What is ostensibly wrong with pain? There are many times where we'll actually purposefully do something that inflicts pain upon ourselves. If you have a sliver, you often have to inflict pain to get it out. And the pain doesn't really bother you some of the time, because you're doing it intentionally. Your mind is in such a place. I was talking to a surgeon, came to meditate, and he couldn't believe how painful it was to meditate. He'd be sitting there with a backache, and he just couldn't take it. And he said, it's crazy, because I can stitch myself up without anesthetic and be totally fine with it, have no discomfort whatsoever. A lot of pain, but I'm fine with it. Why is it that when I sit here and have this simple back pain, that I just can't take it? And that is the distinction here between physical and mental suffering. Back pain is not that big of a deal. It's actually, when you're sitting still for a while, you get a little bit of aching. But even noises can become intense suffering to us. In the West, we're so sensitive to noise that when we go to Asia, India, for example, anyone who's been to India can attest to the fact that you'll go crazy listening to the honking of the horns, like literally. I was on a tour once through the Buddhist holy places in India, and the monk who was leading us, a Thai monk, he was on the microphone in the bus and he was talking, and the bus's horn was like this, loud, like an air horn. And so every time anyone car came near us, it's not even a means of expressing displeasure. It's just saying, hey, I'm here. But hey, I'm here is like holding down on the horn for a few seconds, even minutes. And he's talking and talking, and eventually the horn goes and he just goes, ah. Hey, this is a monk, and he's a meditation teacher as well, so simple noises can drive us crazy. And the point is that the experiences in and of themselves, again getting back to the middle way of objectivity, if you can become objective about experience, then nothing has the power to cause you suffering, no matter how intense it is. Speaking of cancer, I When I was in California, I tried to teach meditation to someone who was dying of cancer, stage 4 liver cancer. And so I went and I did some chanting for her at first, again, as a means to calm her down. So as she lay there and I went through a bunch of Pali chanting, that meant nothing to her, but was hopefully kind of soothing. And then I taught her how to meditate. I said, watch your stomach. When the stomach rises, say to yourself, rising. When the stomach falls, say to yourself, falling. It's a simple exercise to cultivate objectivity. Rising, falling, rising, falling. And she tried it for a few seconds, and then she grimaced and said, it's too much pain, I need a painkiller. I couldn't take it anymore. So she was stuck. The meditation wasn't possible. It's often the case with people who are in a serious situation like that, well, obviously this won't work, you know, the formal structure won't work and you have to kind of wing it. So I said, well, wait, before you take the painkiller, it's fine, you can take the painkiller if you want, anytime you want, but first let's try something. I said, try for me, focus on the pain. No, it's too much, I can't do it. Just say to yourself, look at the pain, say to yourself, pain, pain, pain. And she took a breath and she was quiet. And I kept talking and I said, and when the pain, if the pain goes away, then come back again to the stomach, rising, falling. When the pain comes back again, go and say pain. And I watched her, and for maybe 1 minute or so, she did it, and she tried it. And then she fell asleep. And she didn't ever need to take the painkiller. So even in extreme conditions, you find that these experiences, you can laugh and you can smile in situations that are excruciating physically. That's the real point of concentration, is to focus your mind to the point where you become objective. So if you're lean on the lust side, then you should even it out with a little bit of waking up about the foulness of the body. If you're a person who is full of anger and hatred and self-loathing and so on, maybe a little bit of love and compassion will help to balance that out. But in the end, the point is to see things clearly. Focus. Concentration actually is probably a bad description. Samma, the word samma means, do we have something in English? Same. It's I'm betting it comes from the same word as the word same in the sense of level. So not one, not the other. Not too much of this, not out of balance. I mean, the sense is balance. Or focus, right? So you get to the perfect balance, not out of focus, but too far, too close, but perfectly in focus. So samadhi, I would translate, if you want to be technical about it, more as focus. So it's not necessarily that your mind becomes stuck on something. In fact, in the end, being stuck is going to be a detriment because you're not going to be able to see clearly. When you're focused on blue, for example, it's not much you get out of that. Your mind becomes calm and it's like nice for a while, but when you come out of it, well, did you learn anything about your past, your sad memories or your worries about the future or your enmity towards other people, you know, the problems, the conflicts that you have with your work or your family or your society, internal conflicts and problems, have you resolved any of these? No, it's done nothing. It's taught you nothing about reality. And so concentration in the end can actually become a hindrance, and you have to learn how to be focused on the essence. Focus to such a clarity that you see things as they are. You're no longer blurred. You're no longer seeing more than there actually is. No longer distorted. And that's where that's how it leads to wisdom. That's the only way it can lead us to understanding. I'm going to go quickly through this list, because otherwise people are going to ask, well, what's that? What's this? And then we'll just end up. And then I'll let people ask questions before lunch. So the first is the aggregates. This is basically the physical and mental aspects of one experience. Anyone who's ever heard of the five aggregates in Buddhism might have a hard time getting your mind about, well, where is this aggregate? Where's that aggregate? Because they say this was what makes up a being, but it actually isn't. It's what makes up an experience. Every experience has the physical aspect. Well, every physical experience has the physical aspect. That's the eye or the ear or the nose or the tongue or the body. And the mental aspect. So if I hold this up and say, what do you see? Anybody tell me what they see?
Lights.
You got it. You've been listening to my talks. Cheater. Light. You don't see my fist. Where does the fist arise? Back here, somewhere in the back of your... I don't know, they've figured out where in the brain it processes it, but seeing is the light in the eye. And so it's getting that. It's getting the sense of what is the physical aspect. And then breaking up the mental aspect into its components. There's the sensation, whether it's a neutral feeling, so you see something like a door, doesn't hit you as either pleasant or unpleasant, and so there's no pleasure or pain. But if you feel someone, if someone's massaging your body, or you feel a kitten comes and brushes it against your body, there's a pleasant feeling. And so there's the feeling aspect. And that's still neutral. There's nothing wrong with feeling pleasure. But then you recognize it. So you recognize that this is a cat, or you recognize that that's a door, or you recognize that that's a beautiful person, or that's an ugly person, or that's a friend, or that's an enemy, or that's my father, my mother, my son, my daughter. You recognize it. Again, still neutral. It's not a problem to recognize that that's a door. In fact, it's quite useful to know that that's a door and that's a wall. It's a difference. But it starts to become complicated, because once you recognize that it's your father, then all sorts of baggage comes. And that's the fourth aspect, is our mental baggage. So maybe your father has been overbearing, or your mother has been nagging, or so on. Maybe your children are misbehaving, and you have all these judgments all of a sudden. You see someone you don't like, you remember the things that they did to you, you recognize that's the person who said that nasty thing to me, and then the judgments arise. I'm upset at that person. That person is bad. It's not even a thought, it's a feeling that comes up, bad. And a friend comes, oh good, and you like them. Or someone you're attracted to comes and you feel inclined to chase after them, or so on. A beautiful plate of food, and you start to salivate, and you can't wait to eat, or you think about a cheeseburger, or so on. And finally is the consciousness. All of this, all of what I've explained, is governed over by the consciousness. And this is what gives us the concept of self. So when you sit down and say, do I have a soul? The yes answer comes from the fact that there is consciousness, this feeling of being conscious and aware in the way that this microphone is not. The microphone's very good at passing along information, but it doesn't have a clue what's being passed along. It doesn't experience the vibrations. There's nothing there to experience, which is a distinction in many systems of thought. They would think, well, it experiences it the same way we do, because our brain is what experiences, which is utter rubbish, but people have this idea that that's it, and in fact it's certainly not it. Microphone doesn't know that it's passing on anything. And so those are the aggregates. Every experience is made up of that. Now what do we do with that? We break it down and help to realize something fundamental, that this experience is in and of itself not good, not bad, not of any inherent value to us. Because unlike the plate of food, which conceptually has a lot of value to us, the experience understanding that the experience of seeing the plate of food does nothing for you. It's momentary. You see the plate of food and suddenly your mind starts to can't wait until I can eat that food, and actually causes you a lot of suffering because now you're clinging to it. And until you get that plate of food, so we think, well, eating the food, certainly that's of value, but break it down into what it really is. And you realize that actually it can be thought of as kind of horrific that you have to continuously experience this. And that you have no alternative. You can't stop eating, not for very long. But at any rate, is something that is totally neutral. And there's no good or bad about it. We think, well, tasting, certainly that's wonderful to be able to taste this or taste that. But then when you watch it and you see that the tastes actually are just a moment, the whole wonderful thing, that's this, the mind worrying and saying, oh, how wonderful that food is, how I love this food. You don't love it anymore, you're not even experiencing it. That experience was a moment, and now your brain started, and it started to gather memories. Memories which are very, very dangerous. Because if you've ever studied addiction, addiction starts with a memory. You remind yourself, this brought me pleasure. There's the pleasure, then there's the pleasure that arises, and the pleasure impacts that memory. Why do we remember things that brought us great pleasure, that brought us great excitement? Because you need that energy to fuse it. Just like if you're going to fuse two pieces of metal together, you need the fire. We don't remember things. I'm probably not going to remember what that door looked like in a week, but I'll remember all of the nice people that I met. I'll remember you because it excited me to meet you and to say, oh, these are nice people. You need that glue to stick it together. And once those memories are established, then the next time you see that object, right away you know that brought me happiness and arises the desire. So it's working. We're hardwired to become addicted to things. It's actually quite unfortunate. But it's not hardwired. Sorry, it's something that can be changed. It doesn't have to be this way. It's this way because culture says that's the way it should be. Culture will tell you that good food is a good thing. It's a blessing to have delicious food. But only in the same way, honestly, that it's a blessing to have heroin, because it's a physical addiction. It's one that's much more manageable, but food is one of the only things we are addicted to the extent that we die without it. And so you become objective. You don't reject good food, but you become objective about it so that you don't require it. And as a monk, this is again, getting back to monasticism, this is incredibly poignant lesson that you learn, because I can't say what food I'm going to eat from one day to the next. Some days I don't get nearly enough food to sustain myself, but you live, you don't die. And the next day you get too much food, and I'm looking at the food, oh, I wish I could save this for tomorrow. And you don't know which type of food. I've had food from all over the world. I've eaten more kinds of food than I can remember. And you can't say which food you're going to get the next day or what experiences you're going to have. It's a reminder that actually this is reality. We're all subject to this. None of us can say what's going to come today, tomorrow, a week from now. And since we can't predict, the option of covering all our bases, covering the whole world with leather, just doesn't seem to cut it, to make sense. But if you can understand that the aggregates are the basis of experience, everything is an experience. And when you see something good, see something bad, it's just seeing. And you realize you see the experience of it. Break it up and it disappears. It arises and it ceases. Okay, I'm not doing very well at the quickly through these things. The bases and the elements, let's just skip that one. It's more about the bases of reality. You can divide the aggregates up into lots more. The faculties as well, but the truths are the Four Noble Truths. And again, I'm sure all of you know something about the Four Noble Truths, but really it's a practical teaching. It's not maybe as dogmatic as it sounds. The point is that first we make an admission that suffering exists. We don't deny it, as many people in the world do, and try to spend all our time avoiding it, chasing after pleasure. So we chase after pleasure saying, oh, no, no, I can avoid suffering. Suffering is not a part of life. I can be free from it. And so they become addicts in whatever way. We become addicted and we require certain things and suffer far more than a person who avoided, who declined to engage in addiction when we lose the things that we're addicted to. And so the admission that there is suffering is the first step, because it helps you to look for a better way to actually overcome the suffering and to realize that the second truth is that suffering is only caused because you cling to things. If you didn't seek out or after this or that, if you weren't looking for something, if your expectations were not out of line with reality, so things are this way, if you were fine with that at all times and okay with the way things were all the time, then there would be no suffering for you. The cause of suffering is in our minds. It's not in the world around us. We make ourselves suffer because we want things to be other than what they are. The third noble truth is the opposite, the cessation of suffering. Cessation of suffering comes about when there's no clinging. When you stop, you don't suffer. No clinging, no wanting, no desiring, no suffering. So if you don't desire the plate of food, you won't suffer waiting for it or when you don't get it. Not mentally, you will not suffer. And the fourth one is the path, so the cause of not suffering. It's the truth and the cause, then the truth and the cause. So the fourth one is the cause of not suffering. And this, these three things, this is the cause of not suffering, when you cultivate objectivity, basically. Dependent origination, that would take hours to go through, but it's highly impressive, so I'm sorry that I'm not going to get to it. Basically, cause and effect. Dependent origination actually breaks up the Four Noble Truths into something far more complex or complete, talking about how ignorance, when you don't understand the experience, it leads you to want. It's what leads you to desire it. Say, oh, well, that's going to make me happy. And so you cling and you go after it. And finally, until finally, you suffer so hard that you realize it's not going to make me happy. And the rest is the actual path of meditation. Maybe I'm not going to get into that. All right. How are we doing for time? Oh, we're way over time. So I'm going to stop there, unfortunately, and because the rest is actually something that is best experienced by the meditator themselves. So I'll leave you with the taste of what is to come, or what would be to come if you were to undertake the meditation practice, by just the teaser of those headings. So please, now, if anyone has questions, I'm here. And we can ask questions at least up until 12, I think, no? We can eat lunch at 12. Because I only eat food in the morning, but morning is actually till almost 1 because we're in daylight savings time. So we're able to cheat a little bit. So any questions?
It's the most weirdest thing, because I actually asked my grandfather that without telling him that I seen the video. And he said, yeah, it'd be proper to say, I have a body. Who is it that has the body? Wouldn't it be more correct to say that I have a body, obviously? So I found that very...
Well, it's because it's the mind which ponders that. When the mind thinks about the body, it is thinking about something that is external to itself. The strange thing is when you look at the mind, Because it's a little harder to say, I have a mind, not in the same way. Because then it's the mind saying it about itself. Anyway, questions? No, I want questions because we don't have much time. Hearing works as well. Hearing may work better. Because it sounds like you're trying to drill it out of yourself. Get rid of it, which is not objective anymore. Hearing would probably be better because that's clearly what's going on. But also it has to be objective so that you're really saying to yourself, it's cool, I'm hearing. No problem. It's not a problem. It's a problem that meditators get into. They think, something's wrong, I'm still thinking. Something's wrong, I'm still hearing these songs go through my head that I've been listening to. Sakya, it's not a problem. It's a sign that actually you are not your mind. If you were your mind, you could control it. You could say, no, I'm not going to think that anymore. Those thoughts, off. It would be a switch that you could turn. The fact that you can tells you something. It tells you that things are not, there's not the same free will that we think there is. If there was free will, we could just become whatever we wanted.
It's more like having to choose and climb towards a certain direction.
Yeah. But it's very gray. The whole idea of you who gets to choose, the problem is it requires an abstraction, which I've tried to explain, but I have difficulty explaining it. Reality doesn't, there's no, you can't look around and see. You find the laws of nature written out somewhere. So the whole idea of a you is a construct. It's an abstraction from this experience. See, science does this as well. Science, modern science, takes the universe to be a physical, three-dimensional, four-dimensional reality, time-space. But they've already abstracted things. That's already an abstraction. You're already conceiving of that in your mind and saying, yes, this is three-dimensional. But where is that happening? It's happening in your mind, in your experience. So a key point to understand in Buddhism is we don't even go that far. There was a movement called radical phenomenology or phenomenology where they tried to do this and tried to take things from what they realized were first principles of just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. That's the basis of everything, and constructing reality from there. But they couldn't get very far, because you can't get very far. You can't create views based on that. And that's the point. Because when you're free from views, you just live. But that's, anyway, more of a deep Buddhist concept.
I've actually
got a second question. Oh, okay, great. Bonus. Questions?
I'm very interested in being able to develop an ability to be in a middle path and not take view the world more objectively. But some of the struggles with my thinking is when it comes to morality. For example, just the sheer fact of we need to eat. And so when the concept of morality rules in general practices to make sure we're not causing unnecessary suffering.
Uh-huh.
How does that play into our need for being human and eating? Even for the example of maybe not being able to control your food, like how you get your food. For example,
absolutely.
If you get your food from a vegetarian source, but you don't know how it was farmed,
Yeah. This is a point you caught me because this was a point I meant to mention during the morality distinction that I meant to make. First of all, I'm not vegetarian, which makes it even more hypocritical, right? Here I'm talking about, it's not just about pesticides anymore. I actually eat dead animals if it's given to me. But I explained it, I just didn't go into detail, that morality, and this is a crucial distinction, morality in Buddhism is a function of individual experience, individual action. My action, intentional action, and by action, again, I'm just using a word, but the meaning is my mental volition or my mental inclination at any given moment. That is what decides whether something is moral or not. Eating meat need not be, from a Buddhist point of view, immoral at all. If the person eats meat objectively, there is no intention to harm. If I drive my car down the street and a bug hits my windshield, it was never my intention that that bug should hit the windshield. So it's not a problem for me. I can eat even knowing that someone killed, if someone goes and kills a chicken for me, boils it and feeds it to me, I can eat that without any desire for that chicken to come to harm. And there's the distinction, because we're actually not allowed as monks to eat that. If someone kills for us, we're not allowed to eat it. But I still would say it's not killing. I'm not a part of the killing. If I say to you, please go kill me a chicken, I'd like to have chicken soup today, but I saw a chicken running around, you know, kill that, bring it to me. If you do that, then I'm very much culpable for the murder of that chicken. Because in my mind, there was a desire for that chicken to be murdered. But you close the door. We close the door on a whole world of social morality, social responsibility, because from a Buddhist point of view, it is not essential. Because think of what I'm talking about. Again, the problem often is that we look at it from a Judeo-Christian point of view, which creates a whole society, I guess, or a way of life in a way that Buddhism doesn't. Buddhism is primarily concerned with how you can free your mind, from suffering, how you can become a pure individual who doesn't get angry, who doesn't become greedy, who isn't deluded, who is kind and generous and compassionate and helpful and wise. And so if you streamline, if you think of that as the goal, you can see that there's very little that is required to get there. Social responsibility is actually, it's cerebral. It has nothing to do with your state of mind. In fact, you have a lot of activists who can be very angry people. People who are anti, like PETA, for example. They can be very, very harsh individuals. So Buddhism rejects that and confines itself to personal responsibility on a level of momentary individual absolute intentions. If I don't intend for beings to die, I can eat an apple that was sprayed with pesticides without any necessity to feel guilt. Because, no, obviously there's something wrong with that apple. It's the product of a lot of death. But in reality, that's meaningless. It sounds actually kind of cruel, and a lot of people take it to be like Buddhists are just meanies then, because they don't care about these poor insects that are dying to produce that apple. A lot of Buddhists do, actually, and this is controversial. But in the tradition that I follow, in the original Buddhist teachings, a lot of that you will not find basis for people's views that there's something wrong with eating that apple. But in the original teachings, and this is why there were schisms and so on, but in the original teachings, the point, I mean, I could even come up with arguments as to why it's the point, but the point is that your mind can be pure. What can you do to make your mind pure? And that, why there's an argument for that is because it really is all that's important. If everyone's mind was pure, then no one would ever think to spray these awful chemicals on these poor defenseless insects. In fact, we'd be checking our apples to make sure they didn't have a worm, not because we were disgusted by the worm, because poor worm, which is what Buddhists really do, is we honestly are, if I were to find half a worm in an apple, I wouldn't be disgusted so much as saddened by the lot, by the suffering that came to the poor worm. And the fact that it is so ineffectual to think otherwise. People who are I was a vegan for like 3 years in university. I went through this phase. I've been through all of it. It doesn't make you a better person. It doesn't really help the world that much. If it does, it does because it helps to remind people about what's really important, and that is not to kill. But how much better it would be to just start telling people and teaching people what's wrong with killing, and that is that it actually corrupts you. It makes you a worse person. It makes you suffer yourself. When I hear nowadays about people who cheat others, I hear often about how the world, in this world, it's amazing what you find, what you hear about, how one person will cheat another person. And I always feel more sorry for the person who did the cheating, because you think how awful it must be to be that person. You really do, it's not just an intellectual exercise, you really do feel this as a meditator, because you can't imagine being such a corrupt individual. How awful it would be. I mean, I sit in meditation and feel guilty about the smallest thing, about something I maybe got angry at someone and you know, said, oh, look, I can't deal with that right now. I feel guilty for hours about that. I couldn't imagine actually deliberately cheating someone out of their fortune. It would just, that's much more horrific. So it's in fact anyway, it's not the suffering that we're concerned with. Because that's the other part of the argument, is that all of those insects are going to die eventually anyway. Suffering is a part of life, whether it's more or less. We're not really saddened. And so the whole worm thing was a bit of a joke, but it's not really that saddening to think about, oh, all the poor beings that are suffering. It's horrific to think about the people who are doing it. And so people who say, you don't care that all of those beings have had to die, and I'm like, no, I really don't care, because they all die anyway. I mean, care in the sense it's horrific that this is the nature of reality, that death is why do we have to die? Why? No. If there's no answer to that, if this is all there is, birth and death, and then obliviation, then life is meaningless, then it's horrific. It's not just meaningless, it's horrific. But it doesn't faze me to think of pain and even torture. Because as a meditator, I understand, well, that's what we have to deal with. It's much more important. What is the state of mind of the people who do the torturing and undergo the torturing? How can we be ready for suffering? I hope that helped. Questions? She first. Sorry, missed the gun. She got you.
I will ask you a question. My father was very sensitive towards animals and they wasted their lives and they could eat. But yet he had children and he wanted to make sure that they grew up with animals that had been grown without hormones and things. So he grew his own. He would have been slaughtered by someone else and preserved, but he would bring them home to a freezer for at least 6 months for his kids to eat them. He had to make sure his children all had good meat to eat as they were growing up. But he could never eat meat because he couldn't get over the suffering of the animal having given their lives for us to eat.
I understand that, sure. I personally think it's a bit, I mean, it's a very common idea, but I personally think it's still too vague and maybe sentimental, not to sound harsh, but it doesn't, you don't have to be like that, you know. I mean, the point is, you are doing it, you know. The point is he doing bad deeds or is he not doing bad deeds? Because he's killing, he's having animals killed. And so his sentimental feeling that I can't eat meat because, to me, is a little bit beside the point, not nearly as important as the fact that he actually is doing it, you see. Like he's actually causing a lot of suffering to beings, even though he's trying his best to make it ethical and moral, or as ethical as possible.
He had to do it in order for his children,
You don't need meat to be healthy. I am pro-vegetarian, absolutely, but a different era for sure. So I can understand, obviously. I mean, it sounds like your father was a wonderful person, but I'm going to say, in fact, it sounds hypocritical, and most people call us out on it, but I stand by the fact that it would be better to get meat from elsewhere, to get whatever food, just say, this is food for my children to keep them healthy, because that's basically what he's doing. He's saying, I can't eat it, but my kids need, so the best way for me to do it is to have them killed myself. He would avoid all of the cruelty in his mind, because he has to suppress it. Oh, I see. Which, again, is, I mean, just in my opinion, I mean, I'm not judging, but just academically speaking, is beside the point, because we're all going to die, and you know, hormones are just physical things that don't necessarily inform the state of mind. So I know that idea, and a lot of people are vegetarians, vegans, whatever, for those sorts of reasons, and I think it's like not my cup of tea, that's all. It's because it's not really anything to do with ethics, in my mind. It's kind of selfishness. Your reason for not eating meat is because you don't like hormones in meat. I mean, you don't feel bad about the animal that has to be injected with the hormones and so on. Although sometimes that's part of the reason, the torture, the cruelty involved with raising animals, these chickens that have their breasts pumped up with hormones that so they can't even walk, that kind of thing. I agree with that. That's cruel and awful. But I feel worse for the people who are doing it to these poor animals. Can't imagine being such a person. Sorry, next. I'm still learning. I took a year of Sanskrit, and then I went to Thailand. I took a course in Pali in university, but didn't learn much. And then I went to Thailand, and I mean, I've been learning ever since. I did all the memorization. So in Thailand, it's a lot of memorization of grammar and so on. And then I just started reading the texts. The biggest thing is just to start reading, because you can learn all the grammar, and it's such a roundabout way. It's like learning any language. Eventually, the best thing is just to get in there. But yeah, it's been 14 years so far. Just keeps getting better and better, although it's slowed down lately. Do you know Pali, Sanskrit?
No.
Oh, wow. I have a couple of apps. That's the other thing, is I'm a language person. And so I learned how to speak with my computer as well. And me and my computer have a good relationship, so I made a couple of apps. It really is true. People don't know the power of a computer until you've actually talked with it and told it what you want it to do. The rest of us are just tourists. We're just there pushing buttons. But yeah, I made a couple of apps. I made one app for Firefox for the computer, and that was part of learning Pali for me, where you can click on a word in Pali and it conjugates it for you. It figures out what the root was. Even in compounds and just all sorts of horrific nightmares of grammar, breaks it up and gives you the root and looks it up in a dictionary, three different dictionaries. And so making that over the years, now Buddhists around the world use that app. Whenever I talk to Buddhist monks, they'll always say thank you for it and so on. And so yeah, that was part of my learning Pali, was figuring out the grammar and using that app, which really does allow someone who knows basic Pali grammar to read the text. Because the biggest part is, what does that word mean again? Looking it up in a dictionary, not finding it, trying to figure out the conjugation. You just click on it and it looks it up for you. Anyway.
In the Christian tradition of monastic living, what is the community? Is there any sense of community?
Yeah, Father Richard asked that yesterday. Not nearly as much, I understand, as you have here. In terms of the monastic rules, anyway, having said that, the Buddha himself is recorded as having said the most important aspect, or the entirety of the holy life, is association with good people. So community with good people. You know. But that being said, it refers more to the relationship between the teacher and the student, more between the teacher and the student than it does with the community. In the absence or even presence of a good teacher, a community of like-minded individuals who are also striving is very much recognized as an important part of the spiritual development. It's not an important part of the monastic training. And in fact, a part of our community is supporting each other's solitude. It's an important part. Very much and very integral to the teachings is the concept of staying alone, not interfering with each other. Because again, it's Buddhism is all internal, the internal struggle to understand your own experience, which can't happen when you're engaged in dialogue with others. You can't understand yourself, what you're bringing to the table, not easily anyway, when you're engaged in dialogue or interaction, which is potentially going to bring up, trigger your emotional responses and so on.
Just a follow-up on that question. What does it mean to take refuge in the Sangha? I understand that to be the community.
Mm-hmm.
That's the third trigger.
Yes. The word, yes, it means community, but it's referring on is actually to enlightened beings. The community, there's two communities, and that's why I mentioned in the first one, corrected myself in the beginning. What we understand as the normal Sangha is the community of monks. But going for refuge, you don't go for refuge to the monks. You go for refuge to the Arya Sangha, the noble community of beings who have already become enlightened. And so those are the people who you can really rely upon to be not just your teachers, but your supporters in the holy life, people who will encourage you on the path. So it means taking refuge in their teachings, in their guidance, in their instructions, in their ability to pass on the teachings that we're following.
How would you experience that Sangha, that higher Sangha?
Either as a teacher, either as taking one of them as your teacher, or by being in a community of such people, being in a community where the people were enlightened. Because you can't take refuge in someone who is still learning, who is still struggling on the path. The best you can be is moral support, I guess. Because it's always nice to see other people meditating, of course, and see like-minded individuals. In fact, you could extend the noble Sangha, the noble community, to include those people who are striving for enlightenment. So you could say, well, you take refuge in them because sitting around meditating in a group is far more powerful and encouraging than being off alone in the forest on your own. You feel quiet or calm at that time? At that time, do you feel quiet or calm?
No, more aggravated.
Then focus on the aggravation. Aggravated.
Should I expect it to come back if I was sitting
there? It'll come back. You have to breathe, right? No, it's common, but it usually means that there's something else that you're ignoring. Because, you know, if you're breathing, it's going to happen. Especially, it will go away often when there is something so strong that you're ignoring that your body has tensed up, and so there's no movement in the stomach. But when you're relaxed, it's a natural movement. So it's a good indicator that there's something going on. In this case, aggravation. You become aggravated because it becomes subtle, and then that snowballs to the point where the aggravation makes it disappear entirely.
Awesome.
You can notice if you're quiet, if you're feeling calm or quiet. That's another frequent problem people have. They feel so quiet and calm that it disappears. So then you focus on the calm and say to yourself, calm, calm,
would
calm.
Also be okay to say, like, sitting.
And yes, if you really can't find it, then you can just say to yourself, sitting. sitting. But I encourage people to go back to it because there's usually a reason why you can't. But absolutely, it's just an example. Rising, falling doesn't have to be your main object. It's just a good one. If it's really not working, you can just say to yourself, sitting, sitting, just being aware of the feeling of sitting. Anyway, we'll talk more about that after lunch. I'll explain the meditation practice, and then I'm just going to go off in my little room. They've given me the boardroom or something, and let people meditate here, and then you can come and see me one by one, and we'll have individual, because this is really what I'm much more inclined towards, is individual, we call reporting. So you tell me how your meditation is, ask me questions about your meditation, get advice, and I ask you questions and give you instruction about your practice. So we'll just meditate all day, and if people have questions, they come to see me and we talk. Okay? Any other questions that need addressing?
Mm.
11 times the size of the Bible. That's what I'm told. That's without repetitions. It's actually 45 volumes about this thick. This thick. It's huge. But a lot of it's repetition. And the same thing will be found in different spots. But the whole of the teachings is huge. Very, very, very big. And then there's the commentaries. Commentaries and sub-commentaries, which are all in Pali, which in total come out to like 140 volumes. It's big. There's a lot in there. And the other thing is the format of it is much more exegetical. It's much more focused on providing instruction. It's much more a manual, you know, where the Buddha would go to someone and explain to them how to do this, how to meditate, how to deal with this, how to deal with that, giving advice. So it's quite dense. And it's sorted into different parts. Like there's one part that's just lists of things. 3 of this, 4 of that, 5 of this, 7, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. There's books of the book of ones, the book of twos, the book of threes. Just lists of things that the Buddha had talked about at other times that are categorized. Then there's the connected discourses, where anything the Buddha said about this subject is in this book. And anything that was in books, vagas or sections of on one subject. Then there's the ones that are just grouped together simply because they were long. There's the ones that are the middle length, and then there's the long discourses, these two collections. And then there's the miscellaneous teachings. So there's 5 groups of the Buddha's teachings. Then there's all of the rules, as I said, and the backstories of those rules. That takes up 6 volumes. And then there's what is called the Abhidhamma, which, as I said, talks about the 120 different types of mind and all sorts of intricate details about the nature of reality, like kusala dhamma, akusala dhamma, abhyagata dhamma. It just lists them. Kusala dhamma, wholesome realities, unwholesome realities, indeterminate realities. That's it. And then it says, sukhaya vedanaya, sampayutta dhamma, realities that are associated with happiness, realities that are associated with neutral feeling, realities that are associated with pain. It's a complete and pedantic enumeration of reality and the relationships, and just blow your mind, you know, or drive you crazy. But it's all in there, so it's big. But if you're looking, if your question is you're looking for this, for how to get into it, the long discourses or the middle-length discourses are probably the best place to look. If you can find the middle-length discourses of the Buddha or the long discourses of the Buddha. Middle-lengths. Either one. Both are probably really good. They're books about this big. You can get them, I think they're published here in Massachusetts, actually. Wisdom Publications. More than any other, yeah.
Do you have any commentary on being able to develop that practice of objectivity in relation to our context in our world? So, you know, some
it complicates things. No? Simple life is always easiest. Like I said, it's just, as with everything, you have to be careful with it. As they say in Thai, anything that has great power has great potential for harm. So it's not that you can't just say, well, they're just tools, just use them. It's not really true. A power tool has much more, you know, a circular saw, what do you call a hand saw, what is a circular saw, has much more potential to cut your arm off, your hand off, than a manual one. Power tools are more dangerous. So they're part of our wise practice should be knowing how to limit and regulate the use. During a meditation course, we try to enforce that people shouldn't have cell phones or communication. So a lot of Buddhist practice nowadays, we create artificial environments in which to teach people and tell them to leave everything behind for a time. It's always been that way, even in the Buddha's time. They would take time to go off in the forest and give up things that even teaching or so on for their own personal well-being. So you recognize, you would acknowledge in a college setting that you can only go so far. You wouldn't try to say, I can do, you know, they're just tools, everything, you know, this is just speaking, you know, I'm just here talking to people. It's objective, I can be objective. You recognize that your ability to do that is limited. And so you cut your lossage. A lot of what we call triage, you know, what can, you know, that the Christian blessing that you see on the wall all the time, give me the power to the things that I can change and, yeah, know the difference. So you cut your losses and do what you can. Because there's no way around it. And I think often we would like as an answer where it says, well, it's okay. In that case, you don't really have to become a better person. It's because you can't. You just can't do it here. Right? It's just too hard. And that's a bad idea. Another one is, I won't practice now, but when I get to the forest, then I'm going to go all out. Very bad idea. Very bad philosophy. So you try. You strive. Don't underestimate the power of technology, for example. But you strive and you try. I think that's the best answer I could give. Okay, I think we're done, though. That's...
Thank you very much. To be continued, for those who would like to take lunch on campus...